If we're talking about water in the liquid form versus the frozen form, I can see that's a huge factor, because ice is a very different substance from liquid water. But pure temperature versus noise, because you've got to do things in absolute temperature, that's not a big enough a factor as I see it. Let's see what Roy's going to say on this. AC2GS, K2LAW. Go ahead, Roy.
AT2TS. Well, like I said long ago, it's complicated. I don't think we're going to find one factor that's going to account for all these things. I think, unfortunately, it's a number of factors, some of which we can figure out, and a whole bunch of which we don't have a clue about. So, I mean, it's always good to think about these things and to ponder them and to try and rationalize and reason them out, but I don't think somehow we're going to come to a conclusion tonight.
We're not going to come to a conclusion tonight, but at least we've identified some of the variables involved and some of the additional questions. Wes is about to clear it all up for us. N2XJN, K2IW. Go ahead, Wes.
Well, I think Dr. Roy is right. However, I exclude water vapor, but you were talking about damaging factors, if you want me to comment on it.
Hi, WB2HWW, Dick. Just let me make one quick comment. I don't think temperature, when I say temperature, I'm talking about the difference between being 40 degrees or 20 degrees. At 40 degrees, you don't have ice. At 20 degrees, you definitely have snow. And another second thing is this. I think the snow acts like a mirror. If you have I will tell you this much. This may sound crazy, but right after a fresh snowstorm is when you have the best propagation. As you go a couple of days later, this may sound like a joke, but this is what I remember as a kid, that when the snow was dirty, you had worse conditions. I'm not saying that. What I'm really saying is that when the snow gets slushy, you have a difference in propagation. And I can remember the difference when I was running my, you know, trick four line and hanging out on either, whatever, 80 and 40. So what I'm saying is definitely a stick. Right after a fresh, good snowstorm, I always look for a good snowstorm, and that's when you have great operating conditions. And part of my thinking is that the snow acted as a reflector out at 100 miles or 200 miles, and also helped the ground wave. If you want to call it ground wave, or you want to call it just within a couple hundred miles, you really saw better signal. By the way, as far as your thing about using a piece of wire, yeah, I did that myself. I used to have a switch. I would transmit on a better antenna and listen on a piece of wire, because I also had a Hellcraft S85 radio. And I found out that if I had a less of an antenna, I had better signal-to-noise ratio.
Comment?
Probably because of less intermodulation distortion and less receiver overload. If you had put an attenuator into that great big antenna, you may have gotten the same benefit. Comment? Go right ahead. K2LAW.
Yeah, I think we're kind of getting sloppy with nomenclature. Is it that the noise level goes down, the signal goes up, or the signal-to-noise level goes up? What exactly is happening? Because every time it's described, it changes to another thing. So I would appreciate if we can narrow down exactly what the observation is.
Now, I'm going to put some words in on this one, Roy, which maybe will make it a little bit clearer. A simple 80-meter dipole, 30 feet in the air, on 80 meters, has this huge, very broad donut antenna pattern. It's probably around 90 degrees wide in a 3-degree beam width. If I got the dipole set up where the wire is north-south, broadside to the east-west, I'm probably 100 degrees beam width to the east and 100 degrees beam width to the west. It's an extremely broad antenna pattern. There's very little directivity to it. I've got a pretty deep null to parallel to the wire, to the dead north and to the south, if it is a straight piece of wire. If it's an inverted V, even that null to the north and the south disappears. It's almost an omnidirectional antenna. It's more vertically polarized to the north and the south. Almost any 80-meter dipole that you and I hang is never going to be exactly parallel to the ground. It's either going to be dipping in the middle because of the weight of a transmission line, or it's going to be an inverted V because I've got a tower or a tree supporting it in the middle. So the majority of our dipoles are not really parallel to the ground. They are an inverted V upside down or an inverted V the normal way. So therefore, it is almost an omnidirectional antenna. Let me drop. So that beautiful looking dipole, which you and I view as a fantastic thing with high performance, in reality has an extremely broad antenna pattern. That chunk of clipweed wire laying on the table is also a nearly omnidirectional antenna. So the antenna pattern of those two antennas is almost the same. I will admit that the near ground reflection of the piece of wire on the table is a more nebus antenna. So in vertical elevation angle, it's got a fairly different pattern. But in azimuth pattern, they're about the same. And now, so therefore, the piece of wire probably has a standing wave ratio of 1,000 to 1 or considerably greater. As an antenna, if I was just doing pure receiving from a standard signal generator a mile away, so to speak, in an anechoic chamber, we'll say, if I compare the signal strength of the piece of wire versus the high-performance dipole, I can easily get 25 dB stronger signal off the high-performance antenna versus the yucky piece of wire. Let me drop. Now, that's when I'm listening to a signal. The antenna doesn't know the difference between signal and noise. Both antennas are extremely broadband in directivity pattern. A little bit different than Neva's characteristics, vertical elevation angle. But in azimuth pattern, they're extremely broadband. The antenna doesn't know the difference between signal and noise. The yucky piece of wire hears 25 dB less signal and 25 dB less noise of the atmosphere. But the high-performance antenna gives me a nice strong signal strength reading on both noise and signal. Because of my very large dynamic range of my automatic gain control, the signal-to-noise ratio of the two could be the same. Howie is telling us that his yucky piece of wire gives him better signal-to-noise ratio. And even that is not too mysterious, because with his high-performance antenna, on a good day with a zillion signals on that band, and some of them are 50 kc away running a kilowatt, a California kilowatt, 2 miles from his house, he's got all kinds of sources of front-end overload. When he goes to the yucky antenna, 25 dB down, he's not getting the overload, he's not getting the intermodulation distortion, therefore he sees a better signal-to-noise ratio. So, because of the lack of real directivity difference between the piece of wire and the high-performance antenna, let me drop it. The real directivity pattern is only a couple of dB different, but one is 25 dB weaker on signal and 25 dB weaker on noise, and as long as you haven't run out of dynamic range of your automatic gain control, what comes out of the loudspeaker has almost the identical signal-to-noise ratio. When you go through the real numbers of what's going on, at first it sounds strange. I'm not so sure it's very mysterious, though, Roy. You see where I'm going on this. AC2GS, K2LIW.
AC2GS. I don't think it's strange, and I agree with you entirely, and I sort of know all that. It's just, it might be just semantics on my part. It would make life much easier in my brain if Howard would keep on saying that the signal-to-noise ratio improves after the snow, rather than describing it as the signal goes up or the noise goes down, because it can be, those are different things, right? I mean, the signal-to-noise ratio versus just the signal going up or the noise going down and the other factors staying the same. So, you know, I think the reality is that the way it should be phrased is during the snowy weather, the signal-to-noise ratio goes up, rather than to separate the two components unnecessarily.
Very interesting. Let's see if Howie... Looks like that's what you did say, Howie. On that snowy day, when it's fresh, clean snow, you not only get long-distance, fairly nice signals that you can't normally hear, but all those signals have a good signal-to-noise ratio. The noise of the band is weaker, the signals are stronger, therefore you love a clean, snowy day, is what I think you're saying, Howie. WB2HWW, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Dick, from what I can remember, that's actually correct. You would get stronger signals, the signals be 20, 30 over, and the noise level would be less. I mean, the noise went down, the signal went up. I think, if I had to think about it now, what was happening is this. Less stuff going on with power lines, probably, you know, the power lines were dry. You know, they may have had ice on them, but they weren't arcing. There was probably less arcing noise. But I also had a funny feeling, and I, you know, it was just so long ago. What are we talking, 50 years ago, 45 years ago? It almost seems like there was less QR and less natural noise on the band. Acquire the band. That's what I'm trying to get at, Dick. That's what I'm trying to get at. Yeah, he's right. When I say a better signal to noise ratio, what I'm saying is this. The signals are stronger, the noise is less. That's what I'm getting at. As far as the wire antenna, when you go to a smaller antenna, because if you had stations nearby, 5, 10 KC's away, and they were 40 over 9, now they're 10 or 15 over 9, it's going to make a big difference. Even if you had a Drake line. Or if you were using something like a Hellcrafters S85 or some other type of shortwave radio like a table receiver, I would find out that, cutting back, that's why you would use the RF gain control. Yeah, you can get the same thing out of an RF gain control. But also, if you went to a smaller antenna like a clip lead or a few feet of wire, two things happened. You would the noise in the distance would be less. Just remember the dipole had much more of a capture effect, even though that the patterns were pretty close in the horizontal area. I would say that the dipole would pick up signals at a farther distance, and there'd be more noise. Go ahead. WB2HWW.
Yeah, we've got a problem in the word capture effect. I'm not going to go there tonight. We've got to set aside a little bit of time for the space report, Roy. I'm going to pass it back to you. From my point of view, we've made progress. I, for one, know a lot more about the D layer than I knew before. But there's a lot of mystery left yet. Why is the signal-to-noise ratio so good on a snowy day? I don't think we really identify all that's going on here. And the D layer, where is all that loss of signal really coming from? Back to you, Roy, and then we got to start considering going over to the space report. AC2GS, good stuff. We ain't got the exact answer. I think we know a few more of the variables involved. You got it, Roy. K2LAW.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Dick. It was a pleasure. It's kind of funny. I have about 2 pages of material, and all this was generated on basically 2 lines of text. I would like to mention the mailbag email address because I don't think I've done it yet today, and that's the source of this question, and maybe I can finagle some smart guy to ask me some more questions. So please address your questions to mailbag@limarktech.net. Again, that is mailbag@limarktech.net. And if you somehow can't remember that, and if you remember my call sign, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, just put a .com at the end of it and anything at the front of it, and I'll get it. So thank you very much, Dick. Always a pleasure.
Good stuff, Roy. And challenging. We don't have all the answers. And when you talk to somebody like Neil deGrasse Tyson, he says the best thing in the world is to run into a situation where you don't know what's going on. It means you're about to learn something. So he likes situations which are confusing, challenging, hard to answer. So we seem to have created that tonight. And so NASA's got an easier job than we do in that respect, as I see it, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, go right ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N. Yeah, they have a lot more help. That's for sure. And a lot of years of experience. But we have that, too. There's going to be another launch coming up. I'm looking forward to this Friday. And this time it's going to be a SpaceX Falcon 9. And they're going to be launching another Dragon cargo ship to the International Space Station. And it's their 13th contracted flight to the space station since they've started doing this. But this one's going to be interesting because the launch complex site they're using is launch complex site number 40. So LC-40 will now be put back into operation. They've been using launch complex 39A. They actually rent or lease the both sites from NASA. 39A is the one where the shuttles used to take off, and Saturn V. And now that one's getting ready to eventually start launching the Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy is essentially three boosters, three Falcon 9 Heavy boosters attached to one another with a second stage on top of the middle one with the payload on top. But, that's been in the planning. Let's see, 2013 they wanted to do that, but here we are. 2017, they're finally getting around to it. This launch coming up is on Launch Complex 40, which is the one that blew up a little over a year ago, two Septembers ago. They were going to launch satellite for Israel, the Amos 6 satellite, and as that satellite sat on top of the Falcon 9 rocket, they were running some tests. They were filling the tanks, and the thing blew up. And after investigations and looking into the problem, they realized that it was a helium tank. They have a helium tank inside the second stage, which pressurized the system. They were trying low cryogenic temperatures, and they figured out that ice got between the wrappings on the tank and punctured the tank and created a spark, and the whole thing blew up, wiping out the whole rocket, the satellite that they were going to launch for Israel and the whole launch complex 40. They haven't used it since. Since then, they moved over to the launch complex 39A, which they were going to do anyway, and they successfully have launched I believe it's 14 missions from that launch complex all this year. So and then maybe three or four more from Vandenberg Air Force Base. So around 18 missions in 1 year. So they finally got this thing back online. Now they have the capability of launching from two complexes in Florida, one from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and eventually another one in Texas. They're building a launch complex down there as well. But that's still a few years away. Now this CRS number 13 that they're launching to the space station is unique in a way that they're going to use a reused booster, a booster that flew on a cargo ship. Mission, it was CRS-11, so a few missions back, booster came back safely, and they checked it all out, and they're going to reuse this booster, as well as the spacecraft itself. the Dragon spacecraft was used on a ZRS number 6, so, you know, a couple of years ago, but in good shape. They refurbished it and put these two used pieces of equipment on Launch Complex 40 and plan on sending that up to the space station. 2 days later, it should get to the space station, and they should be able to berth it to the station and unload everything. In the meantime, on the 6th, 2 days earlier, the Cygnus cargo spaceship, which is presently berthed to the Harmony module, will be disconnected from the space station with a robotic arm. It'll be set free and eventually burn up over the Pacific Ocean. So Cygnus' mission is coming to an end. That's been attached for a couple of months to the space station. So that's pretty much it for the ISS. I did see it go over the other night on Wednesday night. Beautiful shot right over Ronkonkoma. 89 degrees, or roughly right directly overhead. Clear night. And it was a good sight. There's 6 astronauts on board, 3 from the U.S., 2 cosmonauts from Russia, and 1 from Italy from the European Space Agency. And then 2 nights later, it was a low pass, a much lower pass. I got to see that as well. That was only for a couple of minutes. Probably going to be more passes, but nothing good for probably a couple of weeks. Not at least for our area here in New York. We talked about microphones last week on the net. Are there going to be any microphones on the Curiosity version of this? You know, the second iteration of Curiosity, which is being built as we speak, called the Mars 2020 rover. And that will be launched naturally in 2020. It will be landing in 2021. And we talked about a microphone being on board. I found out there's 2 microphones that are going to be on board. One for EDL, that's entry, descent, and landing. And that will be able to record all the goings on when that's coming through the atmosphere, or, you know, the parachutes popping open and separation of the rocket that's going to be supporting the lander from a couple of tethers. You'll hear the motors and eventually hear the wheels touching down on the planet. So that should be pretty good. Each microphone will be able to record roughly around 3.5 minutes at a time. So they'll probably turn that microphone on late in the EDL. And then there's going to be another microphone mounted to the vehicle itself, to the body of the 2020 rover. So the other microphone is going to be attached to the mast. You know, after it lands, the mast will open up, rise up from the body, and not only are there 2 cameras on board that mast that looks around as it drives, we'll also have video, but they'll have a microphone on that as well. So you'll be able to hear the rover as it rolls around on Mars, which is pretty cool. You'll be able to hear the wheels crunching on the surface. By the way, they're going to have upgraded wheels. They realize the present rover right now has had a lot of problems with the wheels, a lot of big holes in the wheels. But still doing good. They've beefed up the wheels. But you'll be able to hear the crunching of the wheels and the equipment moving on the rover itself. And it's got a practical purpose as well, because it will be able to listen to different experiments that they're doing. It shoots a laser out of the rover, and it'll hit a rock, and they try to figure out what the rock is made out of. And by listening to the sounds, they said that they could detect certain characteristics of those rocks that they're hitting. And the engineering part of it, they'll be able to actually listen to the equipment and motors if there's problems. They'll be able to listen to the rover itself as, you know, to self-diagnose it as it's driving around on Mars or even sitting still. So I thought that was pretty interesting. So that's the story on the two microphones. We tried it in the past, Mars Polar Lander. That was a failure. That didn't make it to Mars. So naturally, that microphone didn't work. This is WS2N. And then there's another microphone that was on the Phoenix mission. And the Phoenix mission was a very successful mission. Landed in a northern latitude of Mars, very cold area, plenty of ice up there, CO2 ice, dry ice. That's what did that mission. They knew that was coming. But they had a microphone on that. Unfortunately, they did not turn that one on as it came in for entry, descent, and landing, and it never did turn on. So this will be the first time we'll be able to hear something from a different planet, and hopefully that all works. The location, they've narrowed the location of where they're going to land this thing. A year ago, they had 8 different possible landing sites. Now they're down to 3. And, you know, for different science purposes, they've picked one of them. Columbia Hills. Now, Columbia Hills is one where Spirit had landed, Spirit rover. Spirit rover was one of the twin rovers that landed back in 2004. And that was, both of them were very successful, but eventually Spirit quit working. Opportunity is still going. But it landed and drove to Columbia Hills and eventually died there. And I think it would be neat because they plan on eventually, if they do go to Columbia Hills, driving the 2020 rover right up to it's located. Wouldn't that be great to be able to take pictures of that? Again, there's practical reasons for it. The engineers would like to see what this thing looks like after quite a few years of just sitting in one spot. Look at the metal, look at the materials, and evaluate them. And for future missions, essentially manned missions, it would be good to know how the materials held up in that kind of weather, terrible weather on Mars for many years. This is WS-20. Okay, another flight that's going to be going up shortly. Not sure the exact date. They gave it a 10-day window. It's something called the Electron Rocket. Electron Rocket is being launched by a company called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab has launched their first rocket about 6 or 8 months ago down in New Zealand. This guy, Peter Beck, built his own launch complex in New Zealand and launched his first rocket from there. It didn't make it to orbit. They had problems with ground control. Ground control lost location of where the rocket was, and they sent an abort command to blow it up. This time they don't expect that to happen. They expect this thing to actually make it to orbit. And they're smaller rockets, around 60 feet tall. They can carry maybe 300 to 500 pounds to orbit. And this guy, Peter Beck, believes that there's a market for this because there's a lot of people that want to put their satellites up. And usually, if they're smaller satellites, they have to wait for a ride. You know, you might be putting a big spacecraft up into space, geosynchronous orbit or polar orbit, and you know, they'll take smaller satellites like CubeSats and things for a ride. But you'll have to wait for that launch window. You have to wait for, if there's a delay, you might get delayed a year or something. This guy has it set up where you go over to Peter Beck and Rocket Lab and say, I need a launch a couple of months from now we'll be able to do it. He'll be able to say, yes, it's going to be $4.5 million. And he'll be able to put the satellite up into space. That's the way his business model is going to work. Well, we'll see what happens. I did want to get in Voyager. We talk about Voyager like 100 times a year. And Voyager 1 has had problems with their thrusters. They're not putting out as much as they would like. They're called attitude control thrusters. There's about 12 of them on Voyager. And they haven't been happy with them. And they do have other thrusters on board. These, they call them TCM thrusters, trajectory correction maneuver thrusters. There's about 4 or 8 of them on the back of the Voyager spacecraft. So the reason they need these, they need to control the attitude. They run these spacecraft where they don't turn. They stay in one position as they go at 40,000 miles an hour away from us year in, year out. So the Voyager needs to stay in one position, have the antenna always pointing back toward Earth. So they don't use the reaction control wheels. They only have them. They use these thrusters. And they still have fuel on board. And they run on hydrazine. But since these thrusters are giving them problems, they want to use the ones in the back that are usually used to change the trajectory of the spacecraft. You know, they use it quite a bit when they were passing the planets, Jupiter and Saturn. And, Voyager 2, it was Uranus and Neptune. Voyager 1 got as far as Saturn, so that these TCM maneuvering rockets were shut down in 1980. Here we are 37 years later, and they sent a command up last week to Voyager 1 to see if they at least operate. And they got a response. They had to wait 19 hours to get a response at the speed of light. That's how long it takes now to get back all the way from Voyager 1. And everything went perfect. So now they're going to use these things for attitude control for the next 3 or 4 years. Keep the spacecraft pointing correctly so that the antenna points properly back toward Earth. So I thought that was pretty cool. Here the thing is, 37 years later, never been fired all these decades later, and they happen to work perfectly. They only have to fire when they do it for microseconds. I think this one was 15 microseconds. So they only have to fire for very short periods of time to do what they need to do to keep the spacecraft going. This is WS2N.
Well, the UH-4-1 was questioned on this subject.
That's amazing that you can turn a mechanical valve on for a couple of microseconds. And I presume all of these thrusters use the exact same fuel tank. Fantastic. Over to you, Paul, and then turn it over to Joe.
Okay, one more quick thing. This is definitely going to sound ridiculous, so I saved it to last, but this is what Elon Musk wants to do. I spoke earlier about the Falcon Heavy that they want to launch from Launch Complex 39A. It was supposed to go off by the end of this year. Actually, it was supposed to go off by 2013. Here we are, 4 years later, and he's finally getting around to it. Found out it's a lot more difficult to do than he thought. He thought he was going to put 3 rockets together and let them go. But he's finally gotten to a point where he can do this. These will be the most powerful rockets out of anything China has or we have or European Space Agency or India. You know, it's going to be, I think, over 5 million pounds of thrust. But he couldn't get anybody to put a payload on this rocket because, hey, this thing might blow up. I don't want to lose a satellite. So even our own government, military, they said, no way. We'll wait until this thing gets operational. Make sure you can do it. Let me drop it. So he's got a picture of himself standing in front of his Tesla Roadster car,
his own car. You know, if anybody knows, Elon Musk makes Tesla battery-operated cars. It's not even a hybrid, and that's what he does, 6,000 of these things. And that's one of his other businesses, among others. He's going to take this car. Now, I'm waiting until I see this happen, although I've seen it on quite a few websites already. And he wants to put it into the payload of the Falcon Heavy vehicle. Whether or not he does this, I don't know, but this is what he said. I still can't believe he wants to do this, but he wants to put it in there and blast the thing into space. And when it separates as a satellite, he's got cameras. He's going to watch his beautiful red sports car float away from the second stage. So I thought that was amazing. Let's see what happens. I don't know if this is going to happen, but this is what you read when you read the internet instead of magazines and books. Back to you, Dick. WS2X.
Go right ahead, Joe, with your question on the subject.
This is directed at Paul. With these thrusters on these spacecraft, Voyager 1, Voyager 2, don't they have to actually fire the thrusters from, like, the opposite direction at the same time, but have one give you a little more thrust, another one, so you have a way of countering yourself? Because if one thruster fired in one direction, wouldn't that cause the thing to sort of spin or change direction until, you know, it wouldn't stop, it would keep on rotating, right? Or do they fire a thruster in one direction and then counter with another thruster from another direction to, stop it? How is that actually done?
I believe Voyager has 12 attitude thrusters. So that, you know, they can actually change the whole attitude of the spacecraft. The other ones, trajectory thrusters are mounted in the back, but yeah, they all have opposing rockets. I think there's 12, and they have them in groups of four, and then each one has an opposing rocket. I know you can see that on the new Horizon spacecraft. By the way, these rockets, they're called, I think they're 108H rockets by Aerojet. They're the ones that make these small rockets. They're about 6 inches long. They've been around forever. They've been on Voyager. They've had them on Cassini, and in fact, New Horizons. New Horizons only launched 11 years ago. I mean, the rockets are a little upgraded, but over the decades, improved. But they're basically the same thing, and they function the same way. They're hydrazine. They don't need oxygen to. They don't need an igniter. All they need is an electromagnetic valve, a solenoid, to open a little poppet needle type valve and let the little hydrazine in, and they're quick little puffs, and that's all they need. And that's what they do. They'll just like you said, they'll fire in one direction, and then they have opposing rockets to stop the spin if they need it. Otherwise, it would just keep turning. You're right, Joe.
Okay, that's easy enough to understand. Here's something else related to that, the whole thing we were just talking about. Can they estimate, by knowing how much they turn a valve on that gives so much thrust, or so many, for lack of a better term, so many foot-pounds of torque, or inches of torque in a certain direction, and knowing how much or how long they turn on the valve, can they estimate the longevity of the supply of this hydrazine fuel? Because you've only got so much on this spacecraft, and you only operate these things so many times before your fuel is exhausted. Am I correct in believing that?
Yeah, I know they had enough fuel on Cassini to last from 2004 until now, and they still had a little fuel left. They knew they were running out, so that's why they deorbited and let it burn up into Saturn. New Horizons got a ton of fuel left. The Voyagers have spent three quarters of their hydrazine fuel I think they went on with probably 300-400 pounds or something of fuel. So I probably down to 100 pounds, I guess. I'll have to check the exact numbers. But you could, they could throttle these things to from anywhere between 0.2 of a pound of thrust all the way up to 900 pounds, I guess, on a larger one. But they could be adjusted, and naturally these time intervals, they literally go most of the time milliseconds for any kind of attitude control. And if you ever look at the LEM, by the way, you can see the LEM, the way that's all laid out with all these different thrusters, you know, the ones that went to the moon. If you look at that, you can see that for every thruster going one way, there's another one opposing that. They had it on the shuttle. It's hard to see on the shuttle, but the way it was built, into the contour of the body of the shuttle. But you can see it real good, like on a LEM. So that's pretty much it. Joe, WS.
They used 3/4 of their fuel supply in 40 years. That's an average of like 1/4 of your supply every 13 years, if I'm thinking about that correctly. So effectively, in a time frame of like 52 years, they would estimate fuel's going to be gone, and you can't steer this thing anymore. Once it goes out and loses lock on the planet Earth, it's bye-bye, baby.
Hold on now. That fuel was used during some of those flybys to correct the trajectory so that you got just into the right window as you flew by each one of those Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, so to speak. So there's where a lot of the fuel was used. I am guessing very little of the fuel was used for station keeping the direction just right. But there's something else wrong here, Paul. First of all, you said you opened the valve for a microsecond. Maybe you meant millisecond. Even though to open a mechanical valve for that brief of time is amazing to me, you can do it. However, there's got to be some other method of stabilization, spinning the spacecraft or whatever. Because if I'm just blasting rockets, I'm going to be juggling back and forth across the dead zone every hour or so. And there's a lot of hours in 40 years. There's got to be something else that's stabilizing this, because you've got to aim that dish to the nearest couple of tenths of a degree at the Earth continuously whenever you want to talk to that spacecraft. And is there just one fuel supply for both station keeping and thrusting? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, they would have liked to have, momentum wheels on board too. But, you know, that would have been, you know, they would have eaten up the power. You know, RTG, radio isotope thermoelectric generators, only produce so much power, and that's it. And they wouldn't be able to utilize that to keep these wheels spinning all the time. So, you know, not all the time, but that would be power hungry, they say, you know. You could do with this forever. Hydrazine works great. It's got a helium backup, pushes on the hydrazine. Some of them have nitrogen. I think Voyager has helium. But, you know, that's what pushes the fuel into the rockets. But, yeah, I mean, they can go down to, I think I've read 15, did I say micro? Probably milliseconds. But very quick blast. In fact, I read that if you heard them go off, it would sound like somebody hitting, you know, a tin can with a BB gun. Quick little ping. That's what you would hear. That's how fast these things come on and off. You can hold them open longer, but all you need to do is keep the spacecraft steady. They call it dead band. Dead band wrecking is the word that they use. So it just kind of like stays in one position. If it starts to drift one way or the other, it'll detect that, and it's got star scopes on it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
in position. So how often do they go off? Probably very little. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that was my next question. On the average day, how often are they firing these positioning jets in order to keep the right dead band? Are they firing them once per week, once per day, once per hour? I mean, each time you fire that and you start moving the spacecraft from the left side of the dead band to the right side of the dead band, depending on what velocity you pick up, you're going to hit the other side of the dead band pretty soon and have to fire it again. How in the world did they get 40 years of life out of that with no inertial wheel? Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, that, you know, I have no idea. Good engineering. Whatever little pump that they give, they'll give a counter pump on the other direction. And if it needed to maybe rotate 1 degree, for instance, it'll rotate it at 1 degree. And then the other one will go, you know, maybe one will go off for, because it was going in one direction. I'm guessing one will go off for 15 milliseconds, and maybe the next one they'll have for 16 milliseconds. Enough to counteract that. I would imagine it's something like that. But that's what it is. You can look. There are no wheels spinning on this thing. You know, it's not a... You know, they would need tremendous amount of power to keep these wheels spinning whenever they needed to adjust this. That's why they didn't use it on this, and they didn't use it on Cassini, and there's no spinning wheels on New Horizon, they said. Back to you there.
Sounds like Hubble should have been done that way. These thrusters must have fired tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of times in 40 years. They are now using substitute thrusters, the ones that we use for wheel thrusting instead of station keeping. The thrusters that are not working so well, does that mean the valve doesn't seat correctly? And by the way, if the valve doesn't seat correctly, you're going to leak away the fuel in a hurry. The one that's not working well, the ones that are not working well, what is their failure? What is they're not working well? They're slow, they leak, they don't open all the way. What is the complaint on the ones that they stopped using, Paul? Go ahead.
I'm going back a few years, right? I believe Aerojet has tested all these thrusters. There's a whole series of them. They use the 108H, they call them. There's been other 108s, 107s, 105s. You know, they have... You know, this company makes these type of thrusters, attitude control thrusters. And what happens is, they've tested them up to, 250,000 cycles. They've done that on Earth. So how many times they've done it in space, I don't know. I don't know if they've gone beyond that. 250,000 arms and off. That's an amazing number. So they're extremely reliable. The problem with the other ones, I believe, is the failure of all these rockets are eventually the catalyst. The catalyst is an ammonia oxide type of thing covered with, or I believe it's iridium. And when hydrazine hits this stuff as it's expanding, it automatically ignites. It goes up to, 1,500 degrees or something, and it actually ignites. It doesn't need oxygen, it doesn't need anything else, and that's how these hydrazine thrusters work. You know, they had them on Gemini, they had them on Apollo. Back to you, Dick.
So the catalyst wears away. So the catalyst is some kind of a coating on the thruster, I guess. And you hit it with the hydrazine, and the catalyst makes the hydrazine explode, ignite, do something. I got a crazy question for you guys. I recently bought something I really need. It's a Mid Harvey product. It's a silicone, high-temperature silicone. It's called High Temperature Red Silicone Sealant. couple of days ago, and I'm worried about whether or not it's out of date. So, on the bottom, it has a code. Hotel Tango, that stands for high temperature, dash, R-E-D, yes, it's red, space, Baker, Oscar, Delta, space, 10/17. Now, the 10/17 means October 2017, and the letters in front of that are Baker, Oscar, Delta. Is that an expiration date, or is that a date of manufacture? What's your guess? I'm worried about whether or not this is out of date. Is the October 2017 date of manufacture or out of date? Only thing in front of it is Baker, Oscar, David, D-O-D. I don't know what that stands for. Got a guess, up, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I only have a guess. Before, on, before or on this date or something of that nature. D-O-D, I don't know.
I guess I'm going to have to go back to the SITHUB and ask them. Doesn't look like anybody knows. I went to their website, can't get a hint. I've never seen Baker, Oscar, David before out of date. Before out of date. Maybe that's what I'm trying to say. So, am I out of date on October of 2017? Here I am almost 2 months later. Okay, we're out of time. This was TechNet number 1679. That was space report number 279. Let's see if Roy's got any final words that he wants to say. Awful glad you were here tonight, Roy. And we've got a lot more information to cover on just the D layer. We haven't even gotten to the EF and F1 and F2. AC2GS for any other comments. K2LIW. What does DOT stand for? You got it, Roy.
Yeah, let me just make a comment. Sid Harvey carries the product, but are they the manufacturer of the product? You might want to try contacting the manufacturer if you can find them on the website someplace.
All the labeling on the container leads you to believe that they are the manufacturer. Okay, Roy, if you're still there, go right ahead.
AC2GS, yes, I'm still here, and thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. It's always a pleasure to do this, and hopefully we'll do it all again next week. And, you can make a career out of propagation. Anyway, just want to mention one last time, the mailbag address is mailbag@limarktech.net. Again, mailbag@limarktech.net. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Be kind to each other, and over to Paul for any final. WS2N for a final. K2RIW, clear and listening. Bye-bye, Paul. You got it.
Okay, 73. I'll probably try to watch the launch. It'll be on NASA TV on the 8th. See how that does it. The booster should fly all the way back to Cape Canaveral. That's always pretty thrilling to watch that. Have a good night, WS2 and clear. We'll be here next week. K2RAW, WHORY. Speaking about propagation, I'm going to send you a picture in the subject line. I'll put my call letters first. I just put call letters, then tick. And it'll be related to a subject I'm going to bring up next week on propagation. WHORY.
Roger, Dodger.
NTE33IW from Toronto. Well, thanks for having the live monitored longisland.com feed up this week. I listen virtually and then switch to radio. Another net. Thank you.
Once again, who was that and what was the message?
33IW, Juliet India, Whiskey, Toronto. And just thanks for getting the streaming net live monitored Long Island. This week. Thank you very much. Switch to the car
real
radio. Thanks again.
Okay, Jim, it sounds like we've enabled something that allows you to get the net, and I guess Eric did that, KE2EJ. Glad you appreciate it up there, Jim. Bye-bye and good luck.
The time is 12:04 a.m., 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.